It is Tuesday, September 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Thailand arrests a second suspect in connection with last month's deadly bombing in Bangkok. We talk with an analyst about continuing weakness in China's economy as the country prepares to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II.
Perhaps a lot of the weakness is actually just as a result of temporary disruption from the preparations for the parade, as well as some factory disruptions around the Tianjin area because of the explosion as well.
And singer Ruby Amanfu issues a new CD called Standing Still. It's all ahead. Thailand's prime minister says a suspect has been arrested in connection with the Bangkok bombing on August 17th. VOA Bangkok correspondent Steve Herman joins me on the line. Steve, what is known about this latest suspect arrested in connection with this deadly bombing?
Well, what authorities are telling reporters is that a suspect was arrested at a village called Pa Rai, and that's right on the border with Cambodia. And this occurred around 11 a.m., and he was spotted by a task force of police officers and troops, which had been dispatched to that area to look for suspects who might be trying to flee Thailand, who were connected to this bombing.
Is the citizenship of this suspect known?
No, it is not, and authorities are being mum on that. Now, a number of television channels here in Thailand, shortly after this suspect's arrest, have circulated images of a Chinese passport. We do not know the authenticity of it. The picture, we can say, does look similar to what we've seen, photographs of the man who was arrested today. The name in that passport is Yusufu Mea Riley, a 25-year-old who was born in Xinjiang in China.
And that, of course, has been a place where there has been quite a bit of unrest involving the Uyghur movement.
Right, and there has been speculation because of warrants out for other suspects that there may be some connection between the bombing at the shrine, where there were a lot of Chinese tourists, and Uyghurs or their sympathizers in Turkey. Today was the first day that authorities came out and named a new suspect as being a citizen of Turkey. And until now, they have been bending over backwards, essentially, not to mention Turkey, not to mention Chinese as possible targets of the shrine bombing. But after Saturday, when we had a 28-year-old man who was arrested, his nationality has still not been disclosed. But he was found with a stack of counterfeit Turkish passports. And there was also a counterfeit Turkish passport with his photograph in it as well.
Are Thai authorities continuing to hunt for other suspects?
Yes. Today we had three more arrest warrants issued, with a photograph for one who is listed as a Turkish male, and sketches of two other, presumably of foreign men as well. And they say that there are other suspects that they're looking for. And they're also asking owners of residences, guest houses, and apartments to inform the nearest military or police officers about any, quote, suspicious individuals that they would happen to see on their premises.
Thanks very much, Steve. That's VOA Bangkok correspondent Steve Herman. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Andrew, what has been the reaction on social media to these continuing arrests in Thailand?
Well, all through the weekend, there was a lot of speculation and questions about this investigation, if it was actually going anywhere, if it was yielding anything. And now people are saying, okay, maybe this has actually yielded something with these arrests. There's also a lot of suspicion about, as we just heard, this connection to Turkey. So a lot of people asking a lot of questions, still in the early stages of getting information, but raising those questions on social media and hoping for some answers. We have trending today the term Holy Year, and this is connected to Pope Francis. Pope Francis has announced from December 8th to November 26th of 2016 that he's calling this a Holy Year. He's allowing priests to forgive women for having abortions if they choose to seek forgiveness. So people are saying that while it's not him changing the church's position on abortion, it's a huge step forward. And he's made a lot of these very progressive steps forward. And so a lot of people praising him on that, saying this is a good step into the 21st century for the Catholic Church, and that Pope Francis is hearing some of the calls for modernization that people have been speaking out about on social media and just in general in media. We also have trending this morning Idris Elba. Now, he's the famous British actor. Anthony Horowitz is the author of the James Bond books. Idris Elba has been rumored to play James Bond. Anthony Horowitz says Idris Elba is, quote-unquote, too street to play James Bond. Now, Twitter is taking umbrage with this, saying too street is code for too black. Of course, Idris Elba is black. People saying it's not okay for Idris Elba, a black man, to play James Bond, but it's okay for Christian Bale to play an Egyptian prince in the movie Exodus. So people calling out a lot of contradictions with that. And this might actually, people are noting, push Idris Elba into the role. People saying, look at all this great response that he's getting. It would be silly not to have him as James Bond because so many people are saying he should have that role. So more to follow on that for sure. And then hashtag back to Hogwarts. This is, as happens a lot on social media, we take real days, as this case, September 1st, and that was the day that everyone returned back to Hogwarts in the Harry Potter books. So people are posting hashtag back to Hogwarts, saying, I wish I could go to Hogwarts instead of my real school, saying, where is platform 9 3/4? Of course, the famous train platform from the book, and just sharing some nice moments from the Harry Potter books and movies. So that's trending this morning, and surely to be trending throughout the day as we have little wizards and witches around the world who wish they could go off to learn the tricks of the trade.
Yeah, Hogwarts, not a bad place to be.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Well, in other news here in the U.S., the U.S. State Department has released a new batch of about 7,000 pages of Hillary Clinton's official email messages sent from her private server while she was Secretary of State. About 150 messages of those released Monday were retroactively upgraded to classified status. The leading Democratic presidential hopeful has been losing support as the controversy over her emails deepens. Zlata Sahok reports the crisis has no quick end in sight, as more than half of Clinton's official messages have yet to be scrutinized.
The latest opinion poll shows Hillary Clinton has lost about 20% of Democratic voter support since May, and that Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is closing in on her. In the Midwestern state of Iowa, he is only 7 points behind her and is already ahead of her in New Hampshire. Both states are crucial in the primary elections.
This is not anti-Hillary Clinton. This is pro-Bernie Sanders and pro a message that says enough is enough.
Analysts tie Clinton's downslide with each new release of official emails that was sent from her private server. About 150 messages from the latest batch have been upgraded to classified status, adding to the 63 from the previous batch. The State Department clarified Monday that none of the emails contained material that was marked as classified at the time it was sent.
You know, if something was not sensitive or considered sensitive at the time or classified, it could over time evolve that, given who was saying what to whom, and where that source, where that information was coming from, that we would need to upgrade the classification to protect those sources.
Clinton has said that she followed the rules that were in place at the time the emails were sent.
I have said repeatedly that I did not send nor receive classified material, and I'm very confident that when this entire process plays out, that will be understood by everyone. It will prove what I have been saying.
Analysts say even if she's right, Clinton has not handled the email controversy well.
She's not a natural campaigner. She comes across as kind of programmed and a little stiff. And yeah, she says the right things. She says the right things on equality and fairness and minimum wage and things like that. Yeah, she has the right lingo. And she just doesn't have the chemistry, I think, with American voters.
But the presidential election is more than a year away, and analysts say Clinton has time to recover. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
This story might prompt you to get out your broom or vacuum cleaner and do a little house cleaning. But scientists have found that the dust and grime that's been collecting in your home can tell a lot about you. Researchers from the University of Colorado Boulder and North Carolina State University found that the dust, bacteria, and fungi in your home can not only reveal what geographic area you live in, but also the ratio of genders living in your home and if you have a pet. The researchers recruited occupants from about 1,200 homes throughout the continental United States who collected indoor and outdoor test samples at their homes. After reviewing the samples, the researchers found that each of the homes they studied had, on average, more than 5,000 different species of bacteria and about 2,000 species of fungi. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear about Ruby Amanfu's latest CD. Two factory activity indices in China released Tuesday showed continued weakness in the world's second largest economy, with both dropping to multi-year lows. An official manufacturing index called the Purchasing Managers Index, or PMI, fell in August to 49.7, its lowest level since 2012. A separate survey fell to a six-year low of 47.3. On a scale of 100, anything lower than 50 is considered contraction. Julian Evans Pritchard, a Singapore-based economist with Capital Economics, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the decline was not unexpected, given factory disruptions in August, as the country prepared for this week's 70th anniversary activities, marking the end of the Second World War.
About 12,000 factories were shut down around the Beijing and Hebei region, and we think that's created quite a significant drag on output. So, you know, one of the key takeaways is that perhaps a lot of the weakness is actually just as a result of temporary disruption from the preparations for the parade, as well as some factory disruptions around the Tianjin area because of the explosion as well.
Will this be poorly received by markets around the world?
You know, markets are a bit jittery at the moment, especially given China's concerns about a China slowdown. So I guess, you know, it won't be taken that well, although the reading is in line with expectations. So, you know, it's not a huge surprise to the downside either. But it will, I think, you know, crystallize concerns over the Chinese economy. Now, we're less concerned about the outlook than a lot of people. We actually think that a lot of the recent data sort of overstates the weakness, particularly in industry. Given the disruptions I mentioned, and also things like falling commodity prices are putting a drag on investment figures and trade data, because all of those are published in nominal terms. And if you actually strip out the price effects and you just look at volumes, those volumes have held up much better. So we're less downbeat than a lot of people. But nonetheless, I mean, given the weak PMI readings this for August, it seems quite likely that we're going to get another round of weak data in August in terms of industrial production, trade, investment. And that's not going to go down very well in the markets, given the, you know, the existing concerns over Chinese growth.
Do you expect the factory sector and other sectors in the Chinese economy to continue showing weakness for the rest of the year?
We don't, actually. We think that once a lot of these disruptions fade, we should see a bit of a recovery. And in addition to those disruptions, we also think there's a lot of supporting factors coming into play for the rest of the year. So we've had quite significant monetary policy easing since early this year. Now, that takes quite a while to feed through into real activity, but we're starting to see a pickup in credit growth, and we think that should, you know, feed through into stronger activity towards the end of the year. And on top of that, local governments seem to be stepping up spending. Now they've received a larger debt swap quota. The finance ministry is also bringing forward some projects from next year into this year. So although, you know, fiscal spending had a very weak start to the year, and that's one of the reasons why the economy did so poorly in Q1, that spending now is sort of coming into full force. So the combination of stronger fiscal spending, pickup in credit growth, and the easing of those disruptions that I mentioned together, I think those three things mean that we should see some rebound towards the end of the year.
That's Julian Evans Pritchard of Capital Economics in Singapore. He says China continues to face what he calls a structural slowdown, but expects the worst is behind it and the economy should now stabilize and perhaps even recover toward the end of the year. Nevertheless, Evans Pritchard believes Beijing overstates economic performance and will miss this year's target growth rate of 7%. He believes the Chinese economy is expanding somewhere between 5 and 6%. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Singer Ruby Amanfu is known for her collaborations with other artists, including Patti LaBelle, Kelly Clarkson, and White Stripes singer-guitarist Jack White. But now she's going it alone. International Edition's David Byrd looks at the singer, who covers Bob Dylan, Kanye West, and others on her new solo CD called Standing Still.
Ruby Amanfu's father moved their family from Ghana to Nashville, Tennessee, when she was only three. She showed talent as early as third grade when she won a pack of gumballs for singing in a school talent show. Nashville is where music critics began to notice her talent a decade or so later. It's also where she met fellow musician Sam Brooker. The two became Sam and Ruby and went on to complete a selection of songs that became their first EP. The Associated Press called their 2009 album, The Here and the Now, the best album of the year.
I'm walking away from my past pride. The here and the now's what we'll make right if we get to see the more.
Now Ruby Amanfu has a new CD, Standing Still, which covers several top names, including Bob Dylan and Kanye West. She chose their more obscure tunes so that people could hear her instead of the original recordings.
And I wanted this to feel like a discovery for the listener. Even if they do know the artist, they may not know the song, and I want them to also feel a discovery listening to me for the first time, because these songs are really personal to me, and I want to share my personal story in those songs.
The album was recorded in 5 days in a rural Tennessee log cabin. Ruby says that the beauty of making the album that way with producer Mark Howard, a six-piece band, and guest producers, including the Black Keys' Patrick Carney, is that it felt very organic.
You can wake up in the morning and record, and then you can have lunch and record, and then have dinner and record, and maybe have a glass of wine and do something else if you're in the mood. So, you know, instead of having a normal session where you come in and you're on the clock and, you know, you get one or two down, it was a really great way to do it, and that's why we got so much material, is because everyone was just in the same space and really relaxed.
Ruby Amanfu is known for her high-profile collaborations with other artists. She hopes that her fans can hear all she has learned from others in her solo CD.
I'm excited for the support that I already have from the fans who have been with me in those other forms, and I hope that they are proud of what I have to give now, because I feel that learning so much from all of those partnerships has only made me stronger as an individual artist.
Ruby Amanfu's new album, Standing Still, is out this month. I'm David Byrd.
Down, down, how I
shadow on the wall. I would make no sound at all. And when the sun goes down, the shadow on the wall, it cannot be seen.
That's our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com, where we have a range of stories that might interest you. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is making progress in our mission to degrade and defeat ISIL, not only by supporting local forces on the battlefield, but also by eliminating some of its key leaders. In May, Abu Sayyaf, a key ISIL financier who reportedly managed the group's illegal oil sales, was killed in Syria in a U.S. raid. His wife, Sayyaf, was captured. On August 18th, ISIL's second-in-command, Fatih Ahmad al-Hayali, also known as Haji Muez, died in a U.S. military airstrike near Mosul. National Security Council spokesman Ned Price said that al-Hayali's death will adversely impact ISIL's operations, given that his influence spanned ISIL's finances, media operations, and logistics. On August 24th, ISIL operative Junaid Hussein, who was involved in actively recruiting and inciting ISIL sympathizers in the West to carry out lone wolf attacks, was killed in a U.S. military airstrike in Raqqa, Syria. State Department spokesperson John Kirby has noted that while ISIL is proving to be a determined enemy of the Syrian and Iraqi people, these deaths show that ISIL fighters are not invincible. Their leaders' deaths also demonstrate, he said, that this is a career path with a short shelf life. If that is what you want to choose to do with your life, you're going to be held to account. Spokesperson Kirby has also noted that there are times when ISIL has and will achieve a tactical advance. But if an observer looks at what the coalition and indigenous forces on the ground have achieved over the past year, what can be seen is a steady diminution of ISIL's power and influence. They are shrinking their territorial gains, and they are losing leaders. They are losing foot soldiers. They are losing equipment that they can't readily replace. Recently, the Pentagon announced another important development in the fight against ISIL. Pentagon Press Secretary Peter Cook noted that the United States and Turkey have finalized technical details for Turkey's full integration into the coalition's air tasking order. This means, he said, Turkey is now going to be flying alongside with other coalition aircraft, a significant step forward. He noted that Turkey is already allowing the use of Turkish bases for U.S. strikes and supporting aircraft. That's been a very important force multiplier, said Press Secretary Cook, as we expect it will continue to complement our efforts to pressure ISIL on a number of fronts.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. Thank you.
Loving can hurt sometimes, but it's the only thing that I can.